smile. So, new subject time. How does it feel, being back here? Fine, I say too quickly. Just fine, my mother says. Haven't we been having fun? My God, we've done everything. No, I mean, yes, we're having fun. It's been wonderful. Natalie gives me her dazzling, this is just meant for you smile, like she knows all about my mixed feelings as I trot along after our mother like I'm a little kid again. Do you have olive oil? I ask. No, we don't have olive oil. Use corn oil. It's fine, my mother says. And we do not need those vegetables. I told you they're salad. No, that's okay. I'll just run out and grab some at the store, I say. The store? Says my mother. Oh, for God's sake, honestly. You kids with your olive oil. Corn oil is fine. You've been eating it your whole life. I know. It's just that it doesn't have the same taste for the marinade. Natalie, elbowing me in the side and hiding a smile, pretends to duck for cover, and sure enough, my mother explodes. For heaven's sake, what is it with this generation? All of you! There are only certain foods that can pass your delicate systems. Can't have American cheese, Lord, no, or canned vegetables, or bread. Good old ordinary Wonder Bread. A person could die from bread to hear you tell it. And now, corn oil, innocent little corn oil, has to be replaced by the $18 a bottle olive oil. I look over at Natalie, who narrows her eyes at me and cocks one eyebrow. See? Her eyes say. See what you've been missing? Ryan comes in to get another beer, looks at my mom and grins at me, and goes back outside. Well, says my mother to me with a big sigh. Give me the vegetables. I'm going to boil them and put some margarine and salt on them. They'll be just fine. Mom, let Marnie make the vegetables the way she wants them, why don't you? Says Natalie. You know I'm not going to eat any margarine. It's bad for the baby. I am not going to listen to this, my mother says. Margarine is not bad for babies. Mom, will you please just stop? I read a bunch of nutrition blogs, and I know what I'm talking about. So, Marnie, do you ever hear from Noah? Where is he anyway? Natalie asks. My mother takes in a sharp breath and shakes her head. Oh, so, here we go. For heaven's sake, we are not going to talk about him. I just want tonight to be pleasant. Here we are, all together for the first time in such a long, long time, and I want us all to have a good time. Discuss fun things, not Noah. Fun things like margarine? Natalie says, and then she walks over and takes my mother's drink out of her hand and starts massaging her neck. Ah, yes, she says. Here's the place, isn't it? Oh, yeah, I can feel the knot. This is the Noah knot. I'm getting it. My mother closes her eyes and tilts her head back and forth, and Natalie keeps working away at the spot. I take a sip of my wine so that I won't say anything. Because, really? My mother has a Noah knot? My mom opens her eyes and says to me, Honey, let's not drink too much now before we have dinner. You and I didn't have much lunch today, remember? I'm not... My dad comes to the sliding glass door right then to say that the hamburgers are done, and my mother flaps her hands the way she does when events are happening too fast for her, and she starts gathering up the paper plates and the plastic utensils. I reach for the salad bowl, but she says I'm the guest of honor and shouldn't have to do any work. So I tell her that's ridiculous, carrying a salad bowl isn't work, and also I don't need to be the guest of honor. Oh, you, she says. We're just trying to take care of you, sweetie. I just want to make you feel at home here again. And oh my goodness, you two got me so distracted I forgot about boiling your vegetables. It's fine, I say. I'll just put them on the grill. Can we just have the salad, please? Will you humor me on this, for God's sake? Says my mom as she marches out the door. Natalie gives me her what-are-you-gonna-do face. Outside, the heat hits me like a furnace. The late afternoon sun is still beaming right down on us, and the air is thick with humidity, like something you could roll around in. Brian adjusts the patio umbrella so that my mother will be in the shade while she eats, and my sister sets out the citronella candles while my dad lights the no-bug torches. It's like a dance they all perform, everyone knowing their roles. "Sit here by me," says Natalie, and she pats my arm. And Brian hands me the hamburger platter, saying I should get first dibs. My father grins at me across the table, holds up his glass like he's going to give a toast. He stands up, looking formal and overcome by emotion. I feel a little pulse of alarm as he clears his throat.
"To our sweet little Marnie, the survivor. Now I just want to say, Ducky, you've been hit with some hard blows, but I knew you were going to be all right the moment you opened that door to your apartment in Burlingame, and I saw you were baking. Baking! Isn't that what we said, Millie? This girl is going to take care of herself. She just needed to be back among family and old friends."
There's the clink of the glasses as they toast, and then we pass around all the food. The salad and the overcooked hamburgers. My father has a fear of medium rare that rivals what people feel about circus clowns and rattlesnakes. And for a moment, we're all busy with our plates, and I wonder what would happen if I were to suddenly burst into tears. Maybe it's the fuzziness from the wine mingling with the excessive humidity and the argument about vegetables and olive oil. Olive oil. And also the tension from the sky, which I now see is gathering itself for its late afternoon performance event, a violent thunderstorm. But also there's something else, some huge hurting thing taking shape within me. What it means to be here with these two couples who know each other so well that even their squabbles, the ones that bring me up short and make my heart start palpitating, are simply routine for them. They fuss and argue and kiss and somehow just keep plowing along through life, racking up grievances and then forgiving themselves and each other again and again. No one is going to stand up and say, "You know what? I can't do this anymore." And I am an outsider. And yet these people around me are my tribe. The people who have the right by birth and DNA and blood type to have opinions about my life. "Are you okay?" Natalie whispers, and I wish I could stand up and tell them the truth, which is that my mother has no right to have a Noah knot. A Noah knot! That means that they have been discussing him and me so much that Natalie knows just where the knot is and how to cheer my mother up out of it. "And just look," I'd say to her. "Just look at our father, who is so shrunken next to Brian, like he's already abdicating ever so slightly his own place as head of the family. Brian will soon be managing his portfolio and his lawn maintenance plan, will be scheduling the tuning of the furnace, and eventually suggesting nursing homes. And I am just a damaged object they're all trying to patch up and haul back onto the sales floor. They love me. And they will sit with me while I find the necessary prerequisites for their estimation of a happy life, a new job, a new man, a new car, and later on, furniture, a house, some babies. I need endless help, apparently. In the meantime, they say, here's the story we're giving you. California was a mistake. Your life up to now has all been a big, blurry mistake. But luckily, you're moving on. We caught you just in time. My California life, my adulthood, quietly folds itself up like a map and tiptoes away. Nobody but me even sees it go. 11. Marnie. One night, I pass the door of my parents' room, and I can hear them arguing. It's nearly midnight, and she is saying, "Needs more time. She's recovering. Don't you see that?" So, of course, I stop in my tracks and sit down on the floor outside their room. He says, "She's got to get back out there. She needs to get back on the horse.
Something bad happened to her, sure, but she can't let it get her down, can't let it stop her in her tracks.
Ted, that was not just something bad that happened to her, my mother says. Those were two big blows she suffered. Losing her husband and her job?
For a moment, it seems simply a fascinating discussion, as though they're talking about somebody else, or the theory of big blows. I would love to join in. Do I need more emotional rehabilitation, or to get back on the horse? What could be the point of either? What does the research say about such things? Fight or flight? Rest or work?
You know what she needs,
my mother says in that voice of certainty she uses.
She needs to find a man to go out with.
Millie, for God's sake, that is the last thing she needs. Why do you always act like that's going to solve any problems whatsoever? She needs to find herself first. And why am I the only feminist in this conversation? The girl needs a career. Then, if she wants to, she can find a man.
You don't know anything. She needs love.
Well, fine. Maybe she'll meet a nice guy at work. But first, she has to get a job.
Listen,
my mother says, and I'm surprised by the sudden intensity in her voice.
Don't you dare take this away from me.
Ted, right now we have two daughters in this town, and I want to keep it that way.
Imagine how nice life would be if both of them could live in the neighborhood permanently and have nice husbands, and then their children could grow up as cousins, and they'll all be best friends, and they'd all come over on Sunday afternoons, and we could eventually put in a swimming pool.
A swimming pool,
he says, and a swing set, and we could babysit for the kids, you and I. And I think we can get Marnie to stay here, unless you start pressuring her to get a job. She'll go off on her own once again, and we'll just have to worry about her like I did every single night while she was in California. Every single night, Ted, I worried. But if she meets a guy here, then maybe they'll both stay.
Oh, my Lord God in heaven, you are out of your mind.
Nope, I'm right about this, Ted McGraw. It's happened over and over and over again to my friends. If your kids fall in love with a local person, they stick around. It's love, not work, that keeps a person nearby.
And how do you plan to make this happen?
Well, that's just it. I can't.
Well, there you go.
Well, there you go.
Turn off the light, will you? I've got to get up in the morning. Somebody in this house has to work.
I am getting to my feet, about to depart for the couch, so I can think this over more comfortably, when she says quietly, I did hear something interesting today.
I stop in my tracks. I cannot even imagine what that might have been.
If you're going to be like that, then I won't tell you.
It seems I am going to be like this. Please, I'm begging you, turn off the light. You've already got my blood pressure so high I'm not going to be able to sleep.
Fine.
Fine.
Good night. I hope you have very pleasant dreams.
Thank you. I am certainly going to try.
And when our daughter moves away because you push her to work,
Millie, you are driving me crazy. Do you know that? Go ahead and tell me so we can both get some sleep.
It's fortunate he says that, because I'm thinking I'm going to have to pound on the door and demand that she tell all of us.
Jeremy's back in town, she says.
She starts talking very, very fast before he can stop her. He came back 6 months ago when his mom got sick, and now he's a physical therapist with a real practice, and he's living with his mother. And he's a nice guy, and she liked him a lot, and I think this could be just the answer we're looking for.
Who's looking for?
Says my father.
No, really, Millie. Who?
The couch is calling me. I stand up and tiptoe away before I have to hear my mother explain to my father her very misguided notion of my love life. Okay, so Jeremy Sanders was my boyfriend during our senior year of high school, which is the very first year when boyfriends might start to mean something. Like, they could very well be a real part of your future. My parents certainly thought so anyway. Even though Jeremy and I didn't have a whole huge, madly passionate thing going, we were good together. That kind of good, companionly, sweet, adorable, that parents think is going to be enough for your whole life. He was sarcastic and smart, and so was I, and because neither of us fit in with the desirables, we had a great time making fun of everything the popular kids cared about. We made it through high school on our snark alone. And then one day, after we'd done nothing more than routine kissing for months and months, he said, "I think we should take our friendship to the next level." I was only moderately cute back then. He was cute, too, in a kind of understated way. He had dark hair and nice eyes and a slight mustache that clearly needed years to grow into something better, and I didn't understand why he wasn't embarrassed enough at its scraggliness to shave it off until it could be magnificent. But that's the way Jeremy was. He shrugged off imperfections. He was kind of too normal, was the truth of it. Besides that inadequate mustache, he had a standard-issue non-athlete boy's body, a little too plump, and hands that sweated when I held them, oily hair, and pimples on his cheeks. And not that I was so dazzling in the looks department, you understand. I had blonde hair that had a definite greenish cast to it from the chlorine in the pool, and I wore both a dental retainer and glasses. I thought my knees were too sharp and bony, my feet too big. All around us, our classmates were fucking like rabbits, and it struck me as crazy that here we were, sitting in his car one afternoon in the school parking lot, and we were talking about sex like you might talk about whether to go to Taco Bell or try something dramatic like Hardee's. Should we or should we not? I was leaning against the window, facing him, with my legs curled under me. He presented the idea of sex calmly and scientifically, like it would be an experiment. Nothing more than that. "Okay," I said. "I'll do it, but you have to go buy the condoms." His face went pale. "Or you could borrow some from somebody, I suppose," I said. He stared out through the windshield. It was drizzling, the windows were fogging up, and soon we wouldn't be able to see to drive.
"I don't know," he said. "I sort of wanted to do it right now."
"Sex? You wanted to have sex right this minute? In your car? Are you crazy?"
"People do have sex in cars."
I know, but usually they do it in the dark, so all the other humans can't see. Like, the police get involved if they see you having sex in a car." He twisted in his seat, drummed his fingers on the gear shift knob.
"Anyway, I didn't say it had to be in the car. We could go someplace, maybe."
"Well, we're not going to my house. My mother is in and out of there all day long."
"We could go to my house. My mom's at work, and my dad is back in the hospital."
"Do your parents have any condoms?"
"What?"
He stared at me.
"Ew, I can't believe you said that."
"Well, if no one has any, then you're going to have to buy them. I am not going to have sex with you without a condom."
"I know, I know."
I looked at him and felt a stirring of interest. "Do you even know how to use a condom?"
"Yeah, in sex ed. They showed us with a banana."
I'd been absent that day, so he pantomimed pulling something over an imaginary banana, and that made me crack up.
"I don't know," I said to him. "What if we did it and it didn't work out all right, and then we weren't even friends anymore?" "I've been thinking about this, and that's one of my arguments for why we should do it. We're good friends. We'll always be good friends. And if it goes badly, like if we don't like it or something, we can both laugh about it. That's what we're so good at, laughing at things."
"Don't you think we should be, like, crazy in love so we can get through it?"
"Get through it?" he said. "Do you think it's going to be something bad? I think it's going to be awesome. And then we'll have it all out of the way so that when we end up with other people someday, we'll already know what to do. For once in our lives, we'll be ahead of the curve."
So we drove to the CVS, and he went in. I refused to go with him, And then he came right back out and said it was too horrifying. He knew people in there. One of his mom's friends was buying shampoo right that minute, in fact. So we didn't have sex that day, and I remember feeling a bit disappointed when he took me home. I mean, if it had really been important to him, couldn't he have worked up even an iota of courage? So, and now we hit the tragic part for Jeremy and me. 2 weeks later, he sauntered over to me at my locker and said out of the side of his mouth, "So, sweetheart, I got the goods. I ordered us some condoms by mail order, you see, and they came yesterday, and somehow we've got 10 boxes of the stuff, enough for the rest of our lives." He pretended to smoke an imaginary cigar. The thing was, it was 2 whole weeks later, which is forever when you're 17, and everything had changed. I had, against all odds, somehow been plucked from high school obscurity by a guy who was so out of my league that it was pathetic. Brad Whitaker, a guy that Jeremy and I had spent much of the semester making fun of, had asked me out. Never mind that I had had 0 action before this point, now I was on the verge of achieving something approaching coolness. And, as I carefully explained to Jeremy, I was in love. Jeremy was devastated, which I felt terrible about. We had an awful scene, and he said I was making a humongous mistake, that I was a traitor to the cause of irony and sarcasm and normal human intelligence, and, by the way, good luck dating a guy who didn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. Also, he couldn't resist pointing this out. He'd bought a lifetime supply of condoms for me, and now what was he supposed to do with them? Sell them to Brad Whitaker? "Sure," I shot back. "Why don't you do that?" I was in that dopey state of first love, first passion, and so I was immune to Jeremy's pain. I just wanted to get away from him. I was on the brink of one of life's great moments, and why did he have to make me feel so guilty? Later that week, I lost my virginity in Brad Whitaker's bedroom while his parents were at work to the soundtrack of the Backstreet Boys. I remember feeling slightly confused by the sweaty intensity of sex, all the writhing and the pushing, the way it felt more like an athletic event than what I'd been picturing from the passionate kisses in movies I'd seen. Jeremy and I could never have pulled off something that was this dead serious. We would have laughed ourselves sick. Still, I was proud of myself for not complaining about the pain and the disappointment, and also not minding the fact that, overall, Brad Whitaker didn't really care anything about me. I just did what you do in those times of your life when you're trying to make yourself be something you're not. I stepped up my game, tried harder, shortened my skirts, wore my hair in a side ponytail. You'll have to trust me that this was uber cool. And took to lowering my eyes and holding my mouth in such a way that I looked charmingly bored. It didn't really do any good. Brad turned out to be a heartbreaking, narcissistic toothache of a guy, and he forgot that guys are supposed to take their girlfriends to the prom, and he took some other girl instead. I got to be the wronged woman, and everybody felt sorry for me, and my mother said, "You should have stuck with that Jeremy Sanders. Now there was a nice guy." So great. Just great. He's moved back home. Cheers. 12. Marnie. A week later, I'm at Natalie's house painting a mural on a wall in the nursery, having decided that a scene with a budding dogwood tree, a rolling green hill, and a garden of purple tulips would be just the thing to welcome little Amelia Jane to the world, once she makes up her mind to get here, that is. Natalie has been in the kitchen reorganizing her spice cabinet, but when I look up, I see her leaning against the doorway of the baby's room, holding onto her belly and squinting at the wall. I do not think she really likes this mural. Her idea was to paint the baby's room gray. Gray. Can you even imagine what that might do to a newborn psyche? "Would you do me a huge, huge, huge favor?" she asks. "Drive you to the hospital because you're now in labor?" "Stop it," she says. Believe it or not, I have to go to the dentist to get my teeth cleaned, and I honestly don't fit behind the wheel anymore. So will you drive me? How is it that you have an appointment for teeth cleaning now? What if you were in labor? What if you'd already had the baby? I know, she says. My appointment was actually for 3 weeks ago, but the dentist went on vacation and they needed to reschedule. Natalie does not look so good as she gets into the car, tipping herself way back so that she can maneuver her huge stomach without banging it into the dashboard.
How's it going?
I say.
Shut up!
I start the car and fasten my seatbelt. Oh, Amelia, did you hear what your mother just said to me? Don't be scared to come out, baby. She's really a very nice lady. It's just that you're pressing on some of her vital organs, sweetheart. Natalie bares her teeth. I turn the car around to head out to Roosevelt Boulevard, and I'm surprised when she yells at me that I'm going too fast and that there are dips in the road I'm not feeling. But they're there, and they are killing her. I slow down obediently. And then she says, Ow! Nat, are you about to have this baby? No, she says. These are Braxton Hicks contractions. Fake. She takes a deep, ragged breath.
Because I'm just saying, since we're already in the car and all, maybe we should go to the hospital.
She doesn't even answer that, just lies back with her hands on her massive belly and looks like she's in the most amount of pain a human has ever endured, doing little puffing things with her mouth.
Does it hurt a lot?
I say. We pass a lumberyard and a row of shops.
I could pull in here if you want.
Please, I'm concentrating. This is not pain. We don't use the word pain. There is some...
Somewhat.
Marnie, please be quiet.
We finally get to the medical building, a low-slung little stucco building with banana trees and azalea bushes planted out front, and I pull up to the door and get out and come around to help her. But she waves me off, and then, just like that, she loses her footing and she falls down on the pavement with a loud smack.
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, my goodness.
I cry, and I bend down to help her.
Don't move. Let's see. Oh, crap. Did you land on your stomach? Did you hit your head?
No,
I didn't hit my head. Calm down, will you? That was my purse making that noise.
She's lying on her side in the flower bed, her head resting on a big old palm frond, looking up at me through her same old calm-as-anything Natalie eyes. She's not frothing at the mouth or bleeding or giving birth. She's just Natalie, lying there as if she meant to. Then she starts trying to pull herself up and can't.
Here, maybe you shouldn't move. Really, Nat, it could be you broke something.
Stop yelling, she hisses at me, which is weird because I'm almost positive I'm not yelling.
I'm fine, she says. Just help me up, would you? And don't attract attention.
Okay. Here, hold on to me. Can you hold on? I go around to the other side of her and get down on my knees, and I can't figure out where to grab onto her, and she's so big. But just then, a man's large hands show up in my field of vision, and somebody in a white coat is gently grasping my sister under the arms and gradually easing her upright until she's on her feet. And then supporting her gigantic body against his until she can steady herself. I'm still on the ground, scrambling around to get the contents of her purse, which have spilled everywhere, and I can't see his face, only that he has dark hair, and she seems to be leaning against him as he walks her inside.
There, I hear him say. Are you all right?
I'm fine, she says, which is so untrue it's not even funny. But leave it to my sister. I finish picking up all her lipsticks and quarters and wads of tissues, and then I run to catch up with them. A blast of cold air conditioning hits my face when I open the door, and I can hear Natalie saying,
Ooh, it's freezing in here!
Ridiculously cold, he agrees, and that's when I look up at his face
and it's Jeremy Sanders holding on to my sister. Jeremy Sanders. Of course it is. I almost laugh. At first, I think this is all an elaborate ploy by my mother to get us together. She is a busybody with mysterious ways. The color seems to leave his face as he lowers my sister onto a bench next to the elevators. Once he gets her situated, he straightens up and looks at me with wide, round eyes. I must look as shocked as he does. I hear myself saying, "Hi, how are you?"
Marnie.
He looks stunned, but then he manages to recover and says, "And, oh my goodness, this is Natalie. Hi. Wow, are you okay? That was quite a spill you took. Here, take my coat. You're shivering." He starts removing his white coat, which I notice says Jeremy Sanders DPT embroidered over the pocket, whatever that means. Something official, from the looks of him. "No," Natalie says. She's back to being her brisk and competent self now, waving him away, thanking him for taking care of her, but saying she's got to get to the dentist's office, and she's fine. Really, she's just fine. It was just a little slip is all. Nothing to worry about. She's just going to rest here for a second, catch her breath, and then she'll be off. I keep sneaking looks at him. He seems older, of course, but in a good, mature guy way. My mind is filled immediately with the memory of his slouchiness, his nonconformitude, his sloppy snarkiness. None of that is left. He's obviously become a fully invested member of society. Who would have guessed? "Hey, dude, it's great to see you," I say. "So you're a DPT now. Yay, you."
"Yes,"
he says, and smiles at me with even white teeth. I never noticed how really white and even his teeth were. "And, forgive me," I say, "but what is a DPT? "Physical therapist," he and Natalie both say at the same time, and then she grabs onto her huge stomach and lets out a yell.
"I'd say your sister seems to be in labor. I think we should call an ambulance. That fall did not look good," he says in a low voice.
"No," roars Natalie, holding up one hand while she clutches her abdomen with the other. We watch her in fascination, and after a moment, she straightens up and says, "I'm fine. I'm prepared for this." "She's a warrior," I tell him. "So, you're still living here, or did you move back?" He tears his eyes away from Natalie and looks at me.
"Came back about 6 months ago. My mom's getting up there in years and needed some extra help." "And so you're back here too? Or just visiting for..."
He gestures toward Natalie. "The baby? No, I've moved back. This is home. Now. Newly." I shrug and do a ridiculous little dance to show how carefree I am. I am beginning to regret that I'm wearing paint-splattered jeans and that my hair is shoved up into a big, messy knot, although he's certainly seen me looking worse.
"No, totally,"
he says, which doesn't really make any sense, but who cares? He looks back over at Natalie, who is shivering on the bench and breathing hard, and his eyes are round with alarm.
"Really, we should call an ambulance."
"No, this is false labor," Natalie manages. "If the contractions were real, then my Lamaze teacher said..." Suddenly she can't talk anymore and her face has turned pale and she slumps against the wall, panting. Jeremy looks at me.
"I don't know what the Lamaze teacher said, but whatever. She's not here and we are. I think we've got to do something. So, I'm thinking hospital?"
"Definitely. Definitely not," says Natalie, resurfacing from her breathing debacle. "That's not the way this works. You have early labor for a long time before you have active labor. And I did not have early labor, so these can't be..." Just then she looks horrified, and a huge gush of liquid goes all over the floor. "My water broke," she says, Oh my God, this is not what I planned.
Okay, that's it. Ambulance time, Jeremy says, getting out his phone.
Natalie, who would still like to be running the world even while delivering a child, is not having it, however.
No, what we should do is clean all this up, she says, somewhat slowly in her new normal voice. When the amniotic fluid breaks, you still have time.
As though she's reading from some textbook. Natalie, honey, Jeremy's right. Let's go to the hospital, sweetie.
But the birth plan, she says. I do not want an ambulance. Take me in your car and call Brian. Tell him to bring my suitcase and the tennis balls and the lollipops.
Then another contraction hits and she has to stop talking.
Jesus, says Jeremy. I'm definitely getting an ambulance.
And he starts to punch in numbers. My sister holds up her hand, and as soon as the contraction is over, she says,
Take his phone, Marnie. I've got this. I have trained and prepared, and I am the warrior queen, and I am ready. Do not get in my way, because I...
And then she stops, falls back on the bench, starts breathing through her mouth, eyes round with panic. Right after that one, there's another. And another. Jeremy, looking more handsome and more in charge than I have ever known him to be, gives me a meaningful look and then quietly tells the emergency dispatcher the whole situation. And then when he hangs up, he suggests that I call my parents and Natalie's husband. So I do as I'm told. No one answers, but I leave messages all around. While we wait, he tells me it's going to be okay. And somehow, I believe him. Between contractions, Natalie is still screaming about her birth plan and yelling at me to get the car, and then she gives us some information she learned in her childbirth class, information that no longer seems to apply, if you ask me.
The warrior queen is not going to be happy with you and me, he whispers.
I am freaking out, but I say the wisest thing I can think of, which is, when she gets a healthy baby by the end of this, all will be forgiven. And then I cross my fingers.
13. Blix. On the morning of my Irish wake, a.k.a. the Blix Out Party, I wake up to find the Angel of Death hanging out in my room. So, okay. Hi, I say to the angel. I know it's time. I can do this dying thing. I'll die at the party if that's what I'm supposed to do, although that is probably going to freak some of the guests out. But not me. I'm ready when death is. Then I lie back and close my eyes and ask for some white light to surround me, Houndy, and the entire borough of Brooklyn, and then, for good measure, the whole country and the world. I bless the whole planet. Little stars going all over the place. The Angel of Death swirls up around the high ceiling, settles into one of the plaster cracks up there, the one that looks like a dog's nose. That one may be my all-time favorite. Houndy stirs next to me, moaning a little bit in his sleep. Then he sits up and does that epic throat-clearing thing he does every morning, making barking and snorting noises so loud that they could stop traffic. It always makes me laugh, like Houndy is composed only of phlegm and old tobacco products from his misspent youth, when I happen to know for a fact that he is made of seawater and strong coffee and lobster claws. I reach over and rub his back when he's finished, and he turns and gives me a look I can't quite read, which is weird because I can read all of Houndy's looks. Always have been able to. He's the least mysterious man on the planet, which is why it's worked so well between us. He is looking at me. You're not going to get well, are you? I don't know. I suppose there could still be a miracle. Anything can happen. It's getting bigger. You gave your tumor a name and now it's bigger. Don't you think maybe you gave it too much love? You encouraged it. Then he shakes his head. Listen to me talking like this, like any of this is really real. Blix, why the hell couldn't you have used all your whatever, your power to stop this from happening? Oh, Houndy baby, everybody eventually has to make their transition, and I've done what I could. But maybe we have to face it that Cassandra is the way I'm meant to go. Come over here, you big old lug, and let me love on you for a minute. He says no, but then he scooches over and holds on to me. I'll bet he was a fine specimen when he was young, because he still has the strongest, broadest shoulders, and the softest little earlobes, and the reddest cheeks, and a light in his eyes that you don't find on most humans today. One time he said to me, "You know, I had a great six-pack when I was young," and I said to him, "Bragging about beer is so unbecoming for an old man." The truth is that he is still a beautiful man. "Why do you want to leave me?" he says, his voice all choked up. And I can't speak for a minute. I just rub his back in circles, closing my eyes tightly and drinking him in. The smell of him, the way his muscles ripple underneath my hands, the labored breathing that comes out of him in bursts. This, I think, is my life. I am living my life right now. This is the moment that we have. I stroke his head and look deeply in his eyes. There is no answer. I don't want to leave him, but I believe we all create our own reality, so I must have planned this. I can't figure it out, why it went down this way, and it hurts to try to tell you the truth. I just know that some ailments aren't meant to be healed, and that Houndy and I, and Marnie, too, and everybody that I know, are engaged in some kind of dance of our souls, and we are here to help each other. So I tell him this, and he kisses me, and then in his regular voice he says I'm his very favorite lunatic, and maybe I could do a spell to make the lobster simply jump out of the sea so he doesn't have to haul them in today for the party. How would that be? And maybe while I'm at it, I could do a spell that his back would stop hurting, and that we would both live forever here in this perfect little brownstone that threatens every day to fall down around us, but so far hasn't. Okay, I'll try to get the lobsters to come right to you, I say. And I also have another new project that I didn't tell you about yet, but I need to tell you.
I hope it's you staying alive.
Shh. I think Marnie and Patrick are supposed to be together. I'm working on that.
He pulls away just slightly. Marnie and Patrick? Are you out of your mind?
No, she's right for Patrick. I'm convinced of it. They're supposed to be together. That's what all this has been about, Houndy, all of it. My meeting Marnie at the party, Patrick coming to live here in the first place. Who knows how far back this goes?
Oh, no, he says. What are you doing this for, Blix? You can't possibly want to torment poor Patrick any more than he's already been tormented.
Torment? Love is not torment, I tell him firmly. Trust me. These two are a match. I knew it the moment I saw her, but I just didn't know I knew it.
Blix.
Houndy.
He doesn't want love, he's hurt.
He gets up out of bed, pretending to be all grouchy.
Patrick just wants to be left alone.
That is the most ridiculous thing you've ever said to me. Everybody wants love. And the ones who appear to want it the least actually need it the most. Remember when you first came to me, huh? Remember that? You didn't know you wanted love.
Yeah, but with all due respect to your matchmaking ways, let's not overlook that Marnie married Noah. What about that? He's the one she wants.
Well, she did marry him, but he's left her. The universe works in mysterious ways, Houndy, and I know what I'm doing. You just have to trust me. I hug myself and laugh. He starts waving his hands in the air around his head, like there are gnats bothering him. He can only go so far with this kind of talk. And sure enough, he's pulled his clothes on by now, and he goes to the bedroom door to leave, grousing again about how he has to go get the lobsters. And I remind him that Harry said he'd get the lobsters, and then I say, "Okay, you. I think you need to come back to bed for some special attention."
Blix, I don't wanna.
Oh, Houndy.
No.
Oh, Houndy.
No, no, no.
But he is standing at the bedroom door again, trying to hide his smile. I waggle my fingers like I'm sending over some fairy dust. I crook my finger at him. Houndy, Houndy, Houndy.
Damn it, Blix, what are you doing to me?
You know. He comes over to the bedside, and I reach over and lift up his shirt and unbutton the cargo pants he's just buttoned up.
Blix, it's not gonna... Oh.
And then he comes down onto the bed, tumbling, really, and he's laughing in surprise. So I roll him over and put my nose right up to his, and then, and this is an effort, let me tell you, I hoist myself up on top of him and sit there straddling him. And slowly, slowly the light comes back into Houndy, and he gives himself over to me. It's almost like that moment when you're sauteing mushrooms and they give up, yield themselves to you, and the alchemy is complete. That's Houndy and me making love. Mushrooms in a pan. Like we've done for so long, thick and thin, sickness and health, all that. You never know which time is going to be the last time. He wasn't my first love, or second, third, fourth, or maybe even 34th. But Houndy, as I've come to see, simple, uncomplicated, straightforward Houndy is the love of my life. And when I tell him so, he squeezes his eyes shut tight, and when he opens them again, the light of his love nearly blinds me. Lola comes over to help me get ready for the wake. I'm washing bowls and trays while she unpacks the streamers and tiaras and confetti left over from our last bash early in the summer. "I don't know," she says. "Somehow I don't think streamers are quite appropriate for a wake, now are they?" Everything should be appropriate. I'm changing the rules of wakes, remember? I'm going out with a bang. Streamers and whatever else. I personally will be wearing a tiara, and I hope you will, too. I'd like to die in a tiara, as a matter of fact. She turns and smiles at me sadly. "Aw, Blix, you're not dying. I've seen people who are about to die, and they're nothing like you. They're not washing bowls for a dinner party, for one thing, and they're not thinking about sex." Oh, dear. Did you hear us? Did I hear you? Are you kidding me? Damn straight I heard you. I was walking outside on the sidewalk and I thought, that Houndy sounds like... Wait, is that why he's called Houndy? It is, isn't it? He bays like... Oh! She bursts out laughing. That's it. He's an old hound dog. God, I miss that. Sex. Do you really?
Yeah.
No. Really, really? I said yes, but it's been so long it would probably kill me. It'd be like sandpaper down there.
Oh, that's no excuse. They have stuff for that now, at the drugstore. And you could be having sex, you know. You know you could. I can't resist saying it. And speaking of which, how come you're not telling me about that guy who comes and picks you up? He would sleep with you in an instant.
Oh, him. Her face goes cloudy. You sent him, didn't you?
Of course I did. Not him, per se. I don't even know who he is. I just put out in the universe that you needed somebody to love again. So tell me why you're so secretive about him.
You want to know the truth?
Yes, damn it. You tell me everything, except now suddenly you're keeping this man all to yourself. Don't think I haven't noticed how mean you're being.
Well, I haven't told you this because I don't want you making a big deal out of it, putting all your magic dust all over it. He's a friend, okay? From the past. Nothing more than that.
Uh-huh, I say. The truth is, I did concentrate real hard on having her find someone who could win her trust. Someone she'd perhaps known from before. Because Lola is a little bit cowardly when it comes to meeting new men. I wrote journal entries. I did chanting. I threw the I Ching coins. I did a couple of spells just for good measure. And I sent prayers out into the universe. It's all a mix.
See? There you go, doing it again. Matchmaking when there's nothing there. Sorry, just wishful thinking this time, Blix.
I simply smile. Just before the wake starts, Patrick sends word that he can't come. He's feeling pugly, he says.
Pugly.
This is code for Patrick thinking he's too ugly to be in polite company. It's the word we use between ourselves. Patrick isn't just shy. It's that he has a disfigurement, you see. A scarred face and a jaw displacement. He was once in a fire when his kitchen exploded due to a gas leak, and in one instant he went from being relatively handsome and well-adjusted, he said, to being a hideous beast. His word for himself, not mine, because the light that shines out from Patrick's eyes transforms his face. You see that light, and you don't even know about his jaw and his skin, which is stretched so tight in places that it's almost translucent. His light makes you forget all that. But that's how he describes himself, as a hideous beast, because he is the only one who can't see that light. And periodically I have to go down to Patrick's apartment, which he keeps dark and musty-smelling, and also it's filled with old computers and one grouchy cat, and I sit down there with him and try to tell him about the light that other people see in him, and also that he has a soul that anyone would love. He breaks my heart, Patrick does. He promised he would come to the Blix Out. I'm going down to see him. I tell Houndy and Lola, and they exchange a look, but nobody tries to stop me. I put on my long spangled skirt, and Lola helps me zip it up over Cassandra, and then I put on the purple tunic and the shawl that has the lace and the mirrors sewn everywhere, even on the fringe. Lola fluffs up my hair, which is sticking up everywhere, and off I go, trundling down the stairs, down to Patrick's lair. I can't do it today, Blix, he calls from the other side of the door when I knock. Sweetie, I need you to come to my wake, I say. Just open the door a little crack. I have something I need to tell you. After a while, I hear about 5 locks being unlatched, and then he lets me into the apartment, and I go tromping around, and I open all the shades and turn on lights. He's standing there in the darkness, wearing what he always tells me is his work uniform. Baggy sweatpants and sweatshirt, way too big. He's a thin, waifish guy now,
Somebody who would barely leave a shadow. And that's what he intends, I think, to waste away until he's just a smear in the world, as small as a piece of gum you'd see on the sidewalk. He can't be loved anymore, he told me once, so now he doesn't want to bother anybody. He has some horrible job, writing about diseases and symptoms, and so he's steeped in troubles and doesn't want to bother the people of the world with his yawning, gaping need. I get this, I do. Patrick, I say, honey, I can't do it. Listen, I love you, and I think it's fantastic that you're doing this amazing party. It's not just an amazing party, as you call it. It's a wake, an Irish wake. Whatever it is, you don't want me there having a panic attack. I'd ruin the whole mood. We'll stick together. We can do our dance, and then you won't need to panic. One time, when it was just the two of us, we made up a dance in which we wore hats that we pulled down until they nearly covered our faces, and then we threw them up in the air. We might have been drunk when we invented that dance, but we could be drunk again, I tell him. I pick his Hawaiian shirt out of his closet, which contains exactly three shirts, all meticulously hung up and evenly spaced. You look devastating in this shirt, and you know you do. So you can put on that and your straw hat, and we'll dance and drink. People need you there. If you're not there, I'll have to answer the question all night long. Where is Patrick? Where's Patrick? Think of how that's going to be for me. It's going to ruin my whole evening having to explain your absence. He just keeps looking at me sadly and shaking his head. Patrick, I say, honey, we can't undo the scars and the burns. We can't go back to that day, so we just have to figure out how to move forward from it. I go over and gently touch his face, touch the place on his cheek that is nearly sunken in, and the smooth, bright part near his eye where the skin was stretched taut. I take his hand and hold on to it. He is silent, unmoving while I do this, a praying mantis of a man. Can't we find a way together to be in the world in spite of the fire? He tilts his head back and closes his eyes, and I take his hand and very carefully, slowly, drag it over to Cassandra, where she is resting beneath my shirt, and I lift my shirt ever so gently and place his hand on this ball of tumor that even Houndy doesn't want to look at or touch. I wrap his hand around Cassandra, and I tell him her name. I am terrified that he will pull away, that he'll recoil, that I'll see the horror in his eyes before he turns away. Instead, what flickers across his face is compassion. He doesn't move his hand. He says, "Oh, Blix," like a slow exhale. "We are all broken," I say to him, "and we all still have to dance." He sucks his breath in. "I scare children, for God's sake." "And yet we still have to dance." I don't know. Also, I didn't want to have to bring out the big guns here, but I think this really is a wake. I think tonight is the night I'm going to die. "Damn it, Blix, what are you talking about?" "I have some evidence I'm not going to go into, but I'm just saying you might want to come and hang out. Otherwise, I'll have to haunt you for the rest of time." And then I kiss him and kiss him, kiss all the scarred over parts of his face, kiss his eyelids and his forehead, and then I go back upstairs. And I am not surprised, not a bit surprised, when an hour later he shows up to the party, and we slow dance together, Him in his Hawaiian shirt and sweatpants, and me in my spangles and sequins, with Cassandra bouncing around like a baby in a pouch. The tiki torches by then are bright flames against the dark night sky, and people are